And in Brooklyn, Dennis Bernstein, Barack Obama has repeatedly advocated for an expanded war in Afghanistan. His foreign policy team, led by Hillary Clinton and Robert Gates, appears to be gung-ho for the expansion, but well-known author and social critic Michael Parenti thinks it's a very bad idea, and he says that history bears that out. People should take a look at it. Parenti is the author of a new article that appears on Common Dreams and Znet called Afghanistan, Another Untold Story. His recent books include Contrary Notions and, coming up soon to be released, God and His Demons. Michael, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Nice to be here, Dennis.
Good to have you with us. Well, we heard Obama say this a whole bunch of times, that he wants to bring the war to Afghanistan, even Pakistan, and now he seems to have the foreign policy team that wants to do the same thing.
Yeah, and what I tried to do in the article is remind Americans of the history that was going on here, that in fact we're not there just by accident. We just didn't happen in. What you had back in the late 1970s was a revolution that went on in Afghanistan, and you had a leftish military. By left, I mean reformist military, come in, and they started doing all sorts of things like legalize labor unions, put in a minimum wage, progressive income tax, a literacy program, land reform, and also health care, housing, public sanitation. That was under a man named Taraki. Taraki was a poet and a novelist, and he had the backing of this military officer corps that was rather patriotic for Afghanistan and wanted to see some changes and improvements and all that.
And it was a rather enlightened, if not short, adventure. I mean, we saw women thriving in the country, right?
That's right. The king some years before had started some of the reforms for women, but the Taraki government really put it forward, education for women and the like. Well, in a year later, and by 1979, the Taraki government was overthrown by a guy named Amin, who many believe was recruited by the CIA during the years he spent in the United States as a student. So in late 1979, he took over. He stopped all the reforms. He murdered and jailed, or he exiled, thousands of Taraki's supporters. And then he, in turn, was he started to sort of establish a fundamentalist Islamic state. And so it's a militant, fundamentalist, reactionary Islamic version of Islam. I mean, not all Islam is that way. That becomes the buttress against any kinds of secular reforms, progressive left reforms. And he, though, was overthrown in a few months by the remnants of the People's Democratic Party, which was this broad coalition of people that had supported Taraki, and also which included elements within the military. So there they were. They were back in. And but things didn't go really very well because, in fact, there were landlords. There was a big landlord class, and there still is in Afghanistan, who did not like the land reforms. There were the herdsmen and peasants who did not like the idea of their women and children going to school. And there was a number of other things like that. And so they started waging a war against the People's Democratic Party government. And that went on into the early 1980s, and that was supported by the CIA and the Pakistani ISI, which is the CIA, is like the Pakistani
CIA. And this
is
a really important point, because when we the common history about Afghanistan is the Russians came in. We supported the Mujahideen to run the Russians out.
Right.
And that's where U.S. involvement started. started.
Right. American foreign policy and American interventionism is always portrayed in the U.S. press and to the public as being reactive and defensive against some menace that's there, and just compelled to act and commit only because they have to save people's lives, or they got to protect the country, or there's some aggression or something like that. But all of this was happening before the Soviets ever came in. So this war was being waged against the reformist government of Afghanistan, which was really a revolutionary government.
And a very enlightened government that was opening the doors for union or labor action,
right.
Was expanding women's role in society.
Yeah, women were taking over administrative positions. Women were taking leadership positions, or studying engineering, or studying business at the city at Kabul's university. They held government jobs. There were 7 female members of parliament in the 1980s and such. So things started getting rather difficult for this revolutionary reformist government, given the lopsided aid from the CIA, the ISI, the Mujahideen.
The ISI is the Pakistani intelligence.
Right, the ISI, Pakistani. The government repeatedly made requests to Moscow for military assistance. Now, the Russians were already giving, the Soviets were already giving assistance in terms of agriculture, health services, and mining. They were very hesitant to commit militarily because that really was an escalation of commitment. And they knew from history that Afghanistan was a pretty pretty dicey situation to get into. But they went in, finally. And when they went in, it was like throwing red meat, because the CIA then was able to recruit Islamic right-wing Mujahideen from about 40 different nations, including some from Pakistan itself, from Saudi Arabia, from Iraq, from Syria, wherever else. They went in there to now wage a holy war against the godless communists who were in. And so you had this long, ugly war, which ended with the Soviets departing and the PDP government left on its own. The government actually lasted another 3 years, to 1992, about a year, actually lasted a year longer than the Soviet Union itself, which collapsed, pretty much went out. So, poppy growing took over again, it flourished.
So it had gone down.
It had gone down not all that much, because the Progressive Democratic government had not made all that many inroads into some of the regions. So what happened was the Mujahideen warlords came in and they slaughtered and murdered and raped and they tortured the head of the government and killed him, being the nice guys they are. And they ruled the country some number of years. But before you know it, by the mid 1990s, I think it was, the Taliban took over. The Taliban were a especially extreme fundamentalist sect of young people, heavily funded and advised by the ISI of Pakistan and by the CIA.
And the ISI, we should say, really essentially helped the CIA created the ISI and worked very closely with
it. That's right. And this is one of the best kept secrets in the world. The media, there are these memory holes where they just go out, you know, like that Saddam Hussein was supported by the CIA and all. You would never hear it. You would just never hear it. And you never hear that the CIA supported the Taliban and, in effect, helped create it. And once the Taliban came in, they did, if there's anything positive that could be said about these maniacs, is they did put a stop to much of the looting and raping and random killings that the Mujahideen had practiced on a regular basis. So so they were in power. And I would also like to point out how well Washington got along with the Taliban as recently as 1999. Let's see, that's Clinton, isn't it? Yeah. Under the Clinton administration, the U.S. government paid the entire annual salary of every single Taliban government official. By the way, in that international call that brought in all these people, all these Islamic extremists, one particular individual was a man named Osama bin Laden, who came in from Saudi Arabia. He with a bunch of other rich friends of his who helped finance things too. And so he, last seen, was in Afghanistan. So the CIA really, it was a Frankenstein monster. They created this monster. They left the wreckage that's there. It's the same wreckage that they left in Guatemala and in Haiti and in many parts of Africa and parts of Latin America and Asia. It is to prevent the people from any kind of democratic reforms, any kind of land reforms, any kind of self-development, self-education and such. And it gets down to a fundamental issue, is how the world, how's a nation, how a society is going to be organized. Is the land, the labor, the resources, the human intelligence of the society and the capital of the society, is it going to be used for the collective development and betterment of all the people generally, or is it going to be used as the special province of the favored few on the top? And the CIA and U.S. foreign policy has consistently, in each of these countries, attacked anybody who took that first course for a broad collectivist and democratic development. And so what you end up with is, if we can't rule, we'll ruin it, that's all. And they've ruined it. And they've brought ruin, as they've done in Iraq, for instance. Which wasn't very democratic, but at least it was self-defining, self-developing. And, you know, there was education going on, all that. And then when Saddam Hussein proved himself to be a nationalist and was not a client state comprador leader at, jumping when the White House told him to jump, that's when they went after him. So any government that commits economic nationalism, any government that tries to make democratic reforms that help those who most need help, help them to develop themselves and become viable contributors to their society for a collective social betterment, any government that pursues those goals are to be targeted. And that's the story of Afghanistan. And that's what is still going on in Afghanistan. There's also the fact that that the U.S. very much wanted a military presence in Central Asia. And they got into Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan and a few other places, and they built these rather impressive bases, and they built an enormous base in Kosovo also. And they could move in now that the Soviet Union had slipped into history. There was nothing really to stop them here. And Afghanistan was a good jumping off point for that. Afghanistan would also be good for the pipeline that was going to take out the immensely rich oil and natural gas reserves of Central Asia. Rather than depending on a Russian pipeline, which they didn't want to do, rather than going via China and out into the Pacific, they decided they could get a better deal by building their own pipeline through Afghanistan. As it turns out, ironically, I don't think a pipeline through Afghanistan is going to be very safe. The situation today is really, from the White House's point of view, from the imperialist's point of view, the situation is not at all a very promising one. The NATO troops there are not really really doing all that much, you know.
And Obama seems lost on this one.
Yeah, he's making noises. He's got to show that he's tough and he's going to be an interventionist and he's going to be ready to kill people, like Clinton had to show and like they all have to show, that we can kill people, and that means we're tough and that means you're secure now because we're murdering. We can really go out there and whack them and take them out. He even used that phrase, well, if there are these bases in Pakistan, we'll go take them out, you know. I remember seeing our friend Tariq Ali a couple of days after after Obama made that comment, and he's a Pakistani, you know, he was quite upset. I mean, he's absolutely no friend to the current government, but still, I mean, to hear this guy who's supposed to be such a progressive and for change and all that, just talking like he's got to be an American gangster and vis-a-vis the rest of the world. Well, it's a successful policy in the sense that they destroyed a left revolutionary reformist government and dragged the people down to desolation and desperation again, and they established a very imposing military presence in Central Asia, an area they had never been in before, and that's what that's about it. And they've got their hands on all these resources in adjacent countries. If they were smart, they would just negotiate a settlement and a withdrawal from Afghanistan.
Well-